Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. Hey guys, turkey season is in full swing right now, and if you are planning on getting after it, make sure to pick up some Meat Eater Phelps turkey calls to stuff into the old turkey vest or into your fanny pack right now. I carry a few different things. I like to use mouth calls, and I like to use pot calls. Mouth calls or diaphragms, I like them because it gives you hand-free calling, meaning when you're working a bird up close, you can have your gun on your knee, finger on the trigger, ready to roll, and still be making turkey sounds. I like pot calls because I just like pot calls. I enjoy calling with a pot call. Whatever direction you go, including a box call, which I don't personally use too much, but they're fun and great, and I started out with them. Yanni, on the other hand, one of my main turkey hunting buddies, he loves box calls. And what's funny is I'll now and then look to him and give him the look that means get out your box call and find us a turkey. So it's not that I don't like him. I just have Yanni use his. Then I don't have to carry it. Go to Phelps Game Calls. Get calls that are made in the USA and get calls that'll get them close. Find yours at PhelpsGameCalls.com today.
Welcome back to another episode of Cutting the Distance Podcast. I'm Dirk Durham, and I'm in the beautiful state of Oregon with my good friend, Ron Hewitt. Now, Ron is a man who I admire and look up to. He's like almost like a grandfather type figure to me, or a fatherly figure. You know, my dad, my grandfathers have all long passed away, and I feel like that's something that's important in a person's life, is to have someone like that to talk to and to talk about life and hunting and just, you know, we've been bouncing ideas off each other all weekend here, you know, talking about just life decisions and things we did in life. And it's awesome to have that kind of a person to talk to. And I think society today kind of misses out on some of that. You know, there's such a big push with some political folks to take down the patriarchy and all this stuff. But I think it's an important thing we all need in our life, because we can learn a lot from the people who have done things a lot longer than we have and have kind of learned and went through life, done some things, made mistakes, made the right choices. And here we are talking about turkey hunting and elk hunting. What am I doing in Oregon? Well, I'm over here at Ron's. Every year for the last 4 years, he's hosted me. He's like, you know, you got to come over and go turkey hunting. Seems like we're kind of hit and miss. You know, one year I'll get one, and one year I won't, and one year I get two, and one year I don't, you know, and kind of back and forth. But it wasn't for a lack of opportunity. Sometimes I'm just not the straightest of shooters with a shotgun. I'm like, how do you miss a turkey with a shotgun? But anyway, welcome to the show, Ron. I've talked a lot about you on, I've talked to you about you on my podcast. I've talked to you about you on Jim Huntsman's podcast, because Jim knows you. And I've got you on the podcast to talk to you. So welcome.
Thanks, Dirk. I really appreciate it. And I love talking with young people like you that are excited about, I call you young because I'm 22 years older, but I appreciate that, and the fact that you want to mentor people and help them, and that your love for hunting and life and your love for happiness and family, it really means a lot to me. Your friendship means a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy where people's lives intersect. And we've been talking about your life. We've been talking about my life, you know, and non-hunting life, and, you know, where we've lived, what we've done for work, all these different things, places we've been. And it's funny, we have these little places in our lives that have intersected, and we didn't know each other. we still had never known each other or ever knew of each other ever existed until I think it was several years ago on BoSite. There's a forum, online forum called BoSite. And I would always get on there and read people's comments on topics and questions. And I'd try to put in my 2 cents. And one day Ron direct messages me on there and said, "So I think you talked to something about, this area in North Idaho that I hunted and wondered if I hunted there." It was near the town I grew up. And wanted to kind of compare a little bit of notes. And we kind of start talking there a little bit. And then fast forward a few years and you start seeing me on YouTube hunting. And yep. You came by the booth in Portland at the Portland show and introduced yourself. And we sat there in that booth and we talked a long time. And we were like a couple little schoolgirls, and we looked nothing like schoolgirls. But we sat there and talked and got excited and talked about those old places we love to go and our experiences, those places, elk hunting. And we became fast friends.
Yep.
And then you started inviting me over. So.
Yep. I said, need to come over and try turkey hunting the way I hunt turkeys in Oregon, not just sitting, waiting for them to come to you.
Right.
But finding them.
Right. Yeah. And let's face it, there's the camp that loves turkey hunting, and then there's the camps that say turkey hunting's stupid. And I feel like people that say turkey hunting's stupid or whatever, and then they hear the comparison of elk hunting versus turkey hunting, and people say, there's a lot of similarities, they're kind of like hunting elk in the spring. And that will inflame some people. They're like, there's nothing that's similar. But depending on how you hunt the turkeys and hunt elk, there are some similarities for sure.
A lot of similarities in the way you and I hunt both of them.
Yeah.
Very similar.
Yes. Yes. And why I like turkey hunting, what I like about turkey hunting, let's say this. What I like about turkey hunting is it's one of the best times of year to be in the woods. In the fall, I love elk hunting and deer hunting. The fall, like in September, is amazing. You're getting those last few days of summer, but you're starting to get those crisp mornings of fall. You still hear birds. You still hear bees. And then the woods transition into October, November, and it gets colder. Now the bugs are going dormant. The birds have left, and it's quiet. It's like the most quiet time you can have in the woods is in like November, when there's a little bit of snow to like absorb any sound. There's not a bunch of birds flying around. There's no bugs. And the only sound you hear is your breath. And you also may hear a wolf. You may hear a deer grunt. You may hear some of these little wildlife sounds. You might hear a squirrel in a tree. But the woods get very quiet in November. And then that kind of sets the stage for me. Things get quiet. Life kind of gets quiet for me after hunting season. I kind of go dormant too. I kind of hibernate. Once hunting season's over, I've been go, go, go. And I've always been like this, lots of driving to get to and from my hunting spots, spend tons of time in the woods, and then a lot of time away from family. And it's now time I'm going to hibernate. Now I'm going to dedicate all this time to my family and staying home and all winter long. Now I'm cooped up all winter. And by the time spring comes, I am ready to get the hell out of the house. I'm just sick of looking at four walls. I've got cabin fever. I've done all my stuff, whatever, my winter stuff. And it's like, I got to get to the woods. Now, contrast, you go to the woods in the springtime, the woods are starting to wake up. And year to year is a little different on timing. Sometimes in April, it's a little slower to wake up because it's been a little colder. You still have a little snow on the ground. This year, there's not any snow on the ground up where we were at to speak of. And it seems like we're a little further along in the seasonal aspect. It seems, the date aspect is the same, but the seasonal aspect is a little different. We got bugs buzzing around. We got birds tweeting you got a little bit of warm sunshine, but
today,
but the last 2 days was this frigid, ice cold wind that was blowing off the mountains, and it's like, man, it's so pretty out, but dang, I'm freaking cold.
You'd have thought it was the middle of November.
Yeah, right. It's that cold. But that's what I like about turkey hunting. It just gets me out there. I get get to enjoy the woods waking up in the spring.
Yep. Reconnect with nature.
Yeah, again. Reconnect. And also, I love spending time with good friends in the woods. And turkey season, it allows me to do that. I spend time with my friends and people I love and enjoy their companionship. And guess what? We're chasing this crazy thing called a turkey, and they do some stuff that piss me off, and they also do some stuff that make me giggle and be happy. So they can be frustrating, but yet they can be pretty dang fun to hunt too. So what do you feel? Is that kind of how you see turkey hunting, or what do you like about turkey hunting?
Yeah, I think I started turkey hunting back in about 1991 or 92, mm-hmm. and it was the fact that I'd been hunting elk, bugling for elk, and I knew turkeys gobbled, and you could make them gobble.
Yeah.
So I'm going, okay, I want to hear this. I want to experience this. And when I was a kid, I lived in Redmond, and up deer hunting, a turkey flew out of a tree one day and just scared the daylights out of me. And I thought, man, I want to find one of those things and get it and eat it, because I like to forage and take home things to eat. And when we lived in where we moved to now, it's like there's turkeys all around. And I started hunting them, and the gobble on the roost just excites you. But then when they start coming in, it's really exciting. And that was what really drew me to it, is that the similarities between calling an elk in, calling a turkey in, the excitement of it. And like you say, the springtime, I love getting out here in the weather and enjoying the sunshine, and not so much the wind. I don't like that, because it makes it really hard hunting. Yeah. You can't hear anything. And
it's kind of windy here.
Oh, it's kind of windy here. But yeah, that's the draw for me, is to, I just love being outside in the woods, and I can get out there more.
Yeah. I will say, while I'm turkey hunting, then I'll be going along, and we got these turkeys coming in, or we're calling to these turkeys. And the funny part, the elk hunter brain in me immediately says, the wind is wrong. They're going to smell me. I like, the turkeys are coming from this way. They're going to smell me. Like immediately, that's the first thing that enters my head. Like, the wind's wrong. We got to move. And I'm like, oh yeah, we're hunting turkeys. It's that funny little hunter instinct. Like, I've been hunting elk for 35 years. I've been hunting turkeys longer than that, if you can believe that. I've been hunting turkeys longer than that.
Really?
And I've been more successful hunting turkeys than elk. Elk than turkeys. I've killed more elk than I have turkey. I've killed a lot of turkeys, but I've killed way more elk. But anyway, the little things that trigger in my brain while elk hunting trigger as well during turkey hunting. The turkey's coming in downwind. We got to move. No, you don't. It's a turkey. Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, I had to remind myself that. And then as they're coming in, they're getting closer and getting gobbling. And I start feeling that my heart start beating a little bit heavier and faster. And I start feeling my breathing change. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'm starting to feel that same feeling when I'm hunting elk. Now, when I'm hunting elk, I feel like it's a little more drastic. It's a bigger heartbeat. It's a bigger labored breathing.
It's a bigger animal.
Right. I'm going... making that funny breathing while this bull's coming in. But I'm starting to feel some of those same things arise, those same emotions as the turkey comes in. So, you know, people pay good money for all sorts of ways to get an adrenaline rush. You know, they jump out of airplanes, they bungee jump, they do crazy reckless driving. They do all kinds of weird things to get an adrenaline rush. And those turkey hunting and elk hunting kind of scratch those itches. Now, of course, elk hunting is a complete, way bigger adrenaline rush. I got an 800-pound animal with swords on his head coming to kill me. Whereas a turkey, he might peck you and flog you pretty good.
Spur you.
He might spur me. That's not going to happen. But you know, or the elk's not going to kill me once they find out I'm another animal. But they think like the turkey actually is coming in to breed rather than to fight. Yep. But the elk, he's coming to fight a lot of times. But anyway, it still triggers those same emotions. And I like that. I like those feelings, you know, that you just, everyday life, normal life, you just don't get them, you know?
Right.
There's not anything that really duplicates that, unless you're doing daredevil stupid stuff. And
I'm too old for that.
At our age, we just don't do that, you know?
Part of it too is like in the morning when you find them on the roost and you're moving in the dark. Okay, where am I going to, just like elk, where am I going to set up? I need a path. I can get a shot in here. And then you get all set up and give them a few little calls and they're gobbling away at you. And then they go quiet for 5 to 10 minutes before they fly down. And they're looking for their spot, you know, where they're going to fly down, make sure there's no predators down there. And they go quiet and you go, okay, what's going to happen today? Has he got hens? Are they going to take him away? Are they going to come to me? And then you wait for the drama to unfold once they hit the ground.
Yeah.
You never know.
There's a lot of anticipation there.
There is.
Like I find myself, same with elk, I'll be like, oh man, please let this happen. Please let this happen. I have this little thing in the back of my little voice in the back of my head. Please let this happen. Because I'm super hopeful that it'll come in. I'll be able to shoot them. But knowing that it doesn't work that way all the time. And it's just like
most of the time,
most of the time, even elk, it doesn't work that way. But there's always a chance. And you think, is this the one, you know, I'm like, I don't want to screw this up. So, all those same emotions. Do you think hunting turkeys is like hunting elk?
Oh, I think it is. I mean, obviously there's a size difference. You can see elk coming in. Mm-hmm. Once the brush and grass start growing up, a turkey, all you can see is a head sometimes. And it's harder to get a lock on turkeys that way than it is an elk. Mm-hmm. But the turkeys, like you say, they can't smell. You don't have to worry about the wind. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities there. And I just love it for the thrill of calling them in, you know, to try to beat them at their game.
Now, when turkeys hang up and elk hang up, they, I think, this might be crazy opinion, I think it's easier to move in on a bull elk that's hung up than it is a turkey that's hung up, because elk are so big. They make a lot of noise. They're standing, their face, their headgear, their bodies are at a level that is sometimes above the brush line, and you can kind of spot them a little easier than you can a turkey. Like a turkey, they blend in so good if they're not moving and where they're at, they're like, their bodies are a lot of times are hidden by brush. If it's a little bit, you know, brushy country, but they got that damn periscope head that'll peek up over the bushes. And a lot of times you just can't see it until it's too late. And you hear, beep, 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 and then
away they go.
So I think it's easier to like move in on a hung up bull elk than it is a turkey.
I agree, because the turkey's head's always moving. They're bobbing their head all around when their head's up and they're down feeding. They pick it up and jerk it around again looking. And like yesterday, we saw him in the sun. He's out there fanning for his hens. He wouldn't come in to us because he had his little ladies already. And we started moving in on him. Well, we get up close where we put the stock up to this one tree. We thought we could get him there. He had moved. So now we have to move up again. So we sneak on up and I'm kind of looking over the edge where it goes into the shadows and the shade. And I'm going, looking through this little fir tree. I go, oh, I think I see him down there. I thought, oh, there's his head. It's red. You know, I get my gun up on my shooting stick and, God dang it, I can't tell for sure if it's a tom or what. I'm sure it's the tom, but I can't tell for sure. And then he starts fanning. Okay, so he's fanning. And then he goes out of strut. And I go, well, I can't see his head now. You know, we do that for 5 minutes at least.
Yeah, it was very intense.
Yeah, it was. And then I'm trying to sidestep real slow so I can get a really good look at him. And by the time I get over there where I can see, he's not there. So it's like, oh, God dang it. And we head down the hill really slow. And I'm looking in front of me to the right because that's kind of where he was headed, I think. And all of a sudden I catch him off on the left, the hen and the tom, and they start moving. And that was the end of the story on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, but that was so close. Yeah. And that turkey, you could have shot.
I could have shot him through the tree if I knew what it was 100%.
Right. And that, as a responsible sportsman, hunters, we identify our target.
Yeah.
You know, what if that would have been a guy down there moving his hat brim and you thought, oh, yeah, I see something moving. And there had been turkeys there. The turkeys had bypassed him, but there was a guy sitting there. And you're like, oh, yeah, I think I see something. I see something red maybe. bang, you shoot that guy right in the nose.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it can happen. People get shot every year turkey hunting. So there's that aspect. It's not safe around other hunters. You could shoot another hunter. Then also, just catching the right movement. You think you see red. You shoot this turkey. You get down there. It could be a hen. You know, it's easy to make that mistake in a split second. And sometimes your eyes will play a trick on you. And you're like, and I don't know if it's because we want it to like happen so bad. Like, oh yeah, that's the tom. And then you shoot. And then, oh my gosh, that's not the tom. So that would be an unfortunate situation too. So we have to be super mindful of what we're shooting at. Yeah. And that goes for elk too.
Yep.
Elk, deer, you name it. I mean, that's, you know, have to make sure it's the right animal and not a person, and, you know, get a good ethical shot. So,
and like yesterday, if I did shoot it and the hen was standing there, I get two of them. And so I could not tell for sure where the hen was, and I needed to know that. So yeah it was just it was frustrating to say the least.
Yeah. With a scatter gun or a shotgun. I mean, there's blowback. I mean, you can take out two or three turkeys at once, at one time. Like those jakes that come in. We had six jakes come in the morning I shot my turkey. And if I had lined them up just right, I probably could have mowed the whole works down.
They were what, 10 yards from us?
Yeah.
Trying to figure out where the hen was.
Yeah. That was awesome.
And the two big toms strutting in the background behind them. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Hey guys, turkey season is in full swing right now, and if you are planning on getting after it, make sure to pick up some Meat Eater Phelps turkey calls to stuff into the old turkey vest or into your fanny pack right now. I carry a few different things. I like to use mouth calls, and I like to use pot calls. Mouth calls or diaphragms, I like them because it gives you hand-free calling, meaning when you're working a bird up close, you can have your gun on your knee, finger on the trigger, ready to roll, and still be making turkey sounds. I like pot calls because I just like pot calls. I enjoy calling with a pot call. Whatever direction you go, including a box call, which I don't personally use too much, but they're fun and great, and I started out with them. Yanni, on the other hand, one of my main turkey hunting buddies, he loves box calls. And what's funny is I'll now and then look to him and give him the look that means get out your box call and find us a turkey. So it's not that I don't like them. I just have Yanni use his. Then I don't have to carry it. Go to Phelps Game Calls. Get calls that are made in the USA and get calls that'll get them close. Find yours at PhelpsGameCalls.com today.
Some of the mistakes, I'm going to talk about mistakes made the last couple days and what we did right. We didn't make a lot of mistakes, but I will say one mistake that I made is people don't, and I knew better, but I didn't bring a rangefinder with me. You know, we're shooting with a shotgun and I didn't bring my rangefinder. And I'm like, oh yeah, I can judge yards pretty good out to 50 yards or whatever. I'll shoot a turkey at 50 yards with my shotgun. And we had these birds, they come off the roost and they came up, took a line a little higher than us. And we had to get up and sneak up to try to intersect them as they come strutting by. They weren't coming to us. They were going to kind of go over and they were kind of feeding along, but they would strut every now and then. And then, as we see what's happening, we got to climb up this little hill just a little bit real slow and maybe try to intercept them. And I get up there and get in position. I'm like, oh yeah. I'm pretty sure that turkey's close. He's 50 yards, you know, and I put my red dot on him and ka-chow, and I shoot. I watch my pellets from my shotgun fall about 20 yards short. And he just kind of jumps up and flops his feathers a little bit, like, what the heck was that? And then just kind of walks off. Him and the other turkeys just kind of walk off. They might even have gobbled, I think, when I shot.
They did. And another one down below us did, too.
And then they just kind of walked off, and we're like, dang it. So after they got out of sight, I walk up there, and I stepped it off, and it's 75 yards. And I'm like, how did I misjudge 75 yards for 50 yards?
Well, in all fairness on that one, it wasn't a bright morning because there were some clouds in the sky, and it was only like 20 minutes after fly down, you know, into shooting light.
Yeah.
And when you did shoot, I saw the flame come out of your gun. So it was not a bright, you know, it wasn't really good light for judging. And yeah. It was really hard to tell on that one. But
and I'm used to judging elk yardage.
Well, they're a lot bigger to judge.
Yeah. And I'm like, you know, you get to try to look at this little bird compared to an elk.
Yeah.
And you're like, I think that's close enough. No.
Yeah, but when you shot, you thought it was a robin out there.
Yeah. Shoot. But, you know, that is one mistake I made for sure. So fast forward, that was opening morning.
Yep.
And we had all this hope and all this, we felt pretty good about it. And then just our opportunity slipped us by. And then those turkeys, they kept gobbling. But man, those things will cover country.
Like, they took off.
They took off. They didn't ever run, but nope. They were a turkey just walking a normal pace. Once, if they're not feeding, they just start walking. They will outdistance you. Kind of like an elk, easily.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, we kind of followed them over till they dropped in the next canyon, and we could hear them over there at times, and they kind of disappeared. Hear some across the canyon, and then they shut up, and it's like, then the wind started picking up, which makes it just about impossible to hear across canyons.
Mm-hmm.
So what we decided to bail out of there and head to another area I knew that was more sheltered, and I have cameras set up there, and I kind of watch what time they come through these areas, you know, just to have an idea of when to be around to call them. And went up to another area and sat there and what we called for hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, Dirk's sitting under the tree all cameled with his shotgun up, ready and waiting. Ron's leaning against a different tree, kind of gazing around. Pretty soon he gets cold, so he slips out in the sunshine and takes his pack out there and lays down. He falls asleep. I look over, there's Dirk still diligent over there. So
Yep. Since I had the shotgun, I'm like, as much as I want to crawl out in the sun and warm up, I was freezing to death. It was cold wind. I was not dressed right. I had my lightweight warm weather turkey gear on, and it was frigid.
Yeah. And we called for an hour and 20 minutes, and I said, you know, normally if they're going to come in or hear us, they'll be here by now. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's go. We'll go up another little draw and hit another hollow that's sheltered again. And what we get down there and walking along, and Dirk goes, oh, there's a deer. And we look, and it was really hard to see. They were betting, all of a sudden, six of them stand up. We're going, holy smokes, we only saw one of them.
Yeah.
And they look at us, and they decided, okay, let's go up the hill slow, feeding, and they're all doing their duty after they stand up and start walking off. And I says, well, Dirk, when I find deer, I always find turkeys. I said, turkeys and deer like to hang out together here. Oh, okay. We take about, five steps? Dirk goes, turkeys! And there they were right in front of us. They were coming into our calls.
Right behind the deer. They were walking. They walked, within 5 yards of the deer.
Yeah.
They were just hanging out like chums. And what's funny is, I was telling him about hunting in Kansas around deer and turkeys, a lot of whitetails and a lot of turkeys. And the turkeys, they'll get over and get on the corn or whatever. And the deer, they don't like it when the turkeys are there. I think they can make a lot of noise. And I don't know, maybe the turkeys are mean to the deer. I don't know, but they don't seem to like each other too much.
Well, they're competing for the same food source.
Yeah, and I'll make some noise and clear my throat or make some noise or wave my hand outside the blind or the tree and try to get those turkeys to see me and spook off so the deer will be able to come in, you know, with no reservations, you know. And Ron was telling me, he's like, oh, that's weird because my deer and turkeys, they love each other. I got pictures on my trail cams of these deer and turkeys hanging out together all the time. Well, that's weird. So we see deer take five steps. Oh, well, there's the turkeys. They're best friends. The turkeys coming. And Ron had just made some yelps with his box call. And these jakes were on a beeline to us. And we're kind of standing right out in the middle of
out in the sunshine
we're frozen, we're not moving a bit, we're not moving a muscle, and these turkeys are coming right to us. Got to 10 yards and then they weren't paying attention. That you could see, they're looking around, hey, where's that hen at I heard, and they're looking around, and it's funny to watch Jake. They're all kind of grouped together and kind of, you call them a gang of thugs or a gang of teenagers. they act kind of geeky, kind of nerdy, and pretty soon they don't see the hen and they go back. Well, off in the distance, about 60 yards, there's a couple of toms strutting, you know, they're fanning around back there. I'm like, oh yeah, those things need to come. So the Jakes kind of go back over there and then they kind of run around. Jakes will do this funny thing where they run around in circles. If you haven't been around it too much, but if you have, you'll know what I'm talking about. They run around in circles chasing each other. It's kind of funny. It's like animated, you know, they're running around in circles chasing each other in a 6 foot circle.
Then they stop and go the other way.
And then pretty soon one of the big toms would come over and chase them off. Like, hey, get out of here with your nonsense. You know, kind of like an adult would smack the kids. Like, quit screwing around here. And Ron started squawking again with his box. And here they come again. Here they come right back over to us. The Jakes. And the toms keep on strutting. They're not really making any ground.
I think they're back there strutting, saying, okay, lady, here I am. See,
yeah,
me?
Come to me.
They were probably spitting and drumming both, and yeah, we just couldn't hear it with the wind.
It was pretty windy. Yeah. And then I would yelp with my diaphragm, and I think it was a little too low pitched or something. And I heard them yelping too, and it's more like a gobbler yelp. And yep, they would cut loose and gobble. The Jakes would gobble their heads off every now and then when I'd yelp with my reed, my diaphragm. But it didn't really make them come. But when you hit that box, that real high pitch, then they're like, oh, we better go back over there and check things out.
Yeah.
And then finally they come over, looked around, didn't see the hen, went back. And then those toms started like kind of pushing them off and then started working their way to us a little bit. And there was kind of a windfall there and some brush and stuff that we couldn't quite see them or have a shot. And then finally the one tom got out and there was a gap. I was thinking, man, if he puts his head in that opening, you know, is a pretty good, you know, 2 or 3 foot opening and holds it still for a second, I might just shoot him. And he did. And I put my bead. I put a little high because I think he's about 50 yards. And I heard Ron say, shoot. Kabam, I shoot him. And down he goes, flop, flop, flop. Then what happened?
Oh, yeah. So then Dirk runs up there to get him. And I'm sitting there just watching the whole scene unfold. The deer are up to my left. And all these Jakes are standing there going, what the heck is going on? And the other big Tom was looking back at his buddy going, what's happening here? What are you doing down there? And Dirk gets up there and his bird's flopping. And it's on a hill. It starts flopping down the hill. And he steps on the wing to hold it still, pulls out half the wing feathers, and it's flopping on down the hill. And finally they decided, well, I guess he's not coming with us anymore. Let's mosey up the hill. And,
had I had my wits about me, what I should have done is I should have just handed you the shotgun.
Yeah.
But the big bird, the big Tom, he wasn't really exposed real good at that point.
No.
So like we could have played up. But I didn't know, like 50 yards, it's a poke. I was like, you know, did I just stun him? I got to get over there and get my
make sure he's down.
Yeah, I got to put my foot on his neck and make sure he's down because I don't want him to like get his wits about him, run off and then lose the darn thing. Shoot.
Yeah, have him die somewhere where you can't find him.
So. Yeah. So then we giggle and we have a good time and those turkeys are so pretty. Like, you know, at face value at a distance you're like, oh yeah, it's a big black bird, but up close, like the feathers fluoresce all these different colors, hues of green and blues and reds
and oranges
and
yeah, it is beautiful.
They're so beautiful. So and the sun was out, so we sat there and admired these beautiful feathers for a while and took pictures and did all that and giggled a little bit and talked about what happened and you know, then the hard pack came out. We loaded you know, the big turkeys are heavy. Not like an elk though. I'd rather pack a turkey out than an elk, definitely. But anyway, we packed the turkey out and then we had a cold beer and some lunch and that was a pretty good day.
It was a fun day.
Yeah. And then the next day it's Ron's turn and he's got his shotgun and we go out and just like elk hunting, you know, the day before, yeah, we had them gobbling. Yeah, we had them bugling. The next day we go up, we cannot buy a gobble on the roost. We're there well before light and we check all the spots. Like Ron's got this place dialed. Well, if they're here, if they're not there, they're over here. If they're not there, over here. And then all these different places have a lot of turkeys. We check all the spots. They would not gobble on the roost. Just like elk hunting. You have one fantastic day. The next day it's like, what is going on? I can't get a bull to bugle.
Yeah, went down and called across the canyon to see if those birds would gobble at us at least. Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. And we're going, what the heck? Okay, let's head up further up the road and get up there about a mile. And right where we had stopped and called from in the morning, what's that in the road? That's a turkey. We get up there, and there was like, I don't even know, 5 or 6 hens and Jake at least.
Yep.
They went right back up where they were the day before
and
would not talk at all.
No gobbles. Yeah.
Yeah.
There had to have been a mature tom in there somewhere.
There had to be somewhere.
Well, we saw some, I mean, the day before, but still, even that Jake, you'd think he'd you know, bark a little bit, but he didn't say squat.
And that was before before they crossed the road even. They were still on our side. And
Yeah.
So then what, we go up the road another, we go check it out and see how many hunters are up there. And going up the road another couple miles and head in another spot and driving down the road and, Dirk says, oh, there's a hen. And so we, there should be a tom around here somewhere. So we get out and call home. Somewhere off in the distance, tom gobbles. Okay, let's go. So we go down, park in the bottom and get up on the ridge top and head down the ridge. And that was the one that we talked about earlier that I tried sneaking in on because he wouldn't leave. And then after they flew off, Dirk said, oh, I heard one gobble across the next canyon. So we decided to go over there and check it out. And we went down there where that thing was. And by the time we got up there, the wind was that howling, bitter cold. And our faces last night looked like we were sunburned from the wind. We were both red-faced and our fingers were frozen. And that was with the gloves on and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we said, okay, that's enough for today.
Yep. It's funny. The feelings that turkey hunting give you, the motions, right? So one day you think, I am the worst turkey hunter in the world. Like turkeys will humble you. And I know other people are like, oh, turkeys are so stupid. You can shoot them so easy. And I've had days like that too. You're like, turkeys are I'm like the best turkey hunter in the world. This is easy. Like, I don't know why this is not hard. Like, I could go out any day of the week and shoot a turkey. And then the next day you go out and you can't even come close to it. Like, I don't think I'll ever shoot a turkey. You get those same feelings.
It's like they don't exist out there anymore.
Yep. And elk will do that to you too. Like, you'll be like, man, I am the master of the universe at calling in elk. And the next day, it's like, I'm just like the worst, suckiest elk hunter on planet Earth. I can't even get one to answer me.
Yeah, every time I bugle, they run off.
I'll hike around. I can't even jump one, you know. I can't even find them, you know. But that's why they call it hunting, you know.
It's not killing, it's hunting.
Yeah. So back to, we'll talk a little bit about elk hunting because I know people they'll hear about elk hunting maybe more than turkeys, maybe not. It depends on who you are, where you live. You have people in the Midwest and East, they really love turkey hunting, but they probably really love elk hunting too. So I think we'll talk about some elk hunting too, about the good old days, you know, the love of the land that brought you and I together. And That part of Idaho back in the day, if you guys listened to an earlier podcast that I did with George Bedis.
Bedis, okay.
God, I can't. I'm sorry. I'm getting old. Sometimes I just go blank on people's names.
That's a common occurrence as you get older.
Is that a precursor for dementia? I don't know. I hope not, because sometimes I'm just like, gee whiz, what's my own name? But anyway, I'm sorry. So earlier on an earlier podcast, talked with George Bedis, and he hunted the famed Clearwater region of North Idaho back in its heyday. You know, at that time in the elk world, Idaho had the largest elk herd in the nation. Fast forward 40 years, however long it has been, it's probably been 50 years.
Yeah.
And it's probably arguably one of the worst places to hunt elk in the nation. And you and I sit around and talk about the good old days and the fun experiences we had in that country and then what it looks like now. But what was it like back when you went up there, back when you were a younger man and the hills weren't quite as big and steep?
That's for darn sure.
Why do the mountains grow taller as we get older?
Erosion.
It's got to be erosion.
No, we started hunting it in 1989. My good hunting buddy and my brother and I, and it was like, I hunted Oregon a lot. I mean, that's where I hunted only was Oregon, Eastern Oregon. So I'm hunting the lodge poles and the thickets over there, you know, and there's really no brush, not much brush anyway. And we could call bulls in over there, but there was enough people kind of put me off. So I said, let's go try Idaho. So I did some research and picked this spot in Idaho, went there, and I circled spots on my maps. I had a couple maps in the day where I think, okay, there might be elk here and here and here. So we get there the first night, set up camp, and head down the road a couple miles, and just, I don't think it was one of the spots I'd circled. I said, let's go out here and look. So we just park, head out there, and we probably made it a quarter to a half a mile and said, this is ridiculous. We're beating ourselves through brush the whole way. Let's go back to the road and go somewhere else. So we did and went up on this other point and before dark threw out some bugles and got an answer. So, oh, okay, we'll come back here in the morning. This is cool. Mm-hmm. Went down there in the morning and, you know, chased them around to no avail. And we hunted, I think, for 9 days. And we were into elk every day, had them bugling every day. And got some real good close encounters. And I don't remember how far into it, probably about day six, we caught up with some. And I shot one, and he died right in a creek bottom.
No.
And that was our first day in there ever. And, okay, let's took care of him, packed some stuff out that time, and went back down, the three of us, to pack him out. And in Oregon, in eastern Oregon, the brush, you know, the bottoms of the creeks aren't brushy at all. So we load him up and we said, let's just head up the creek, you know. Big mistake. We're fighting through tag alder. We're slipping on the rocks in the creek. And it was a mess. But we finally packed him out and got done with our hunt that year and came home. And on the way home, said, man, that was fun, but we're never going to Idaho again. I can't stand that brush.
Yeah.
You know, and the tag alder thickets, you know, you'd hear a bull there and you just go plowing right through the middle of it. And,
yeah.
Or the, I don't even remember what the other one is down in there, the vine maples and stuff. Mm-hmm. And little did we realize there were trails through there. You know, the elk use trails. They just don't go plowing through like we did.
And yep.
We're dumb boys. Took us a while to learn. And so we're set on our way home now. We're not going back there. That was just too much work and too brushy, you know, so forget it. 2 or 3 months later, you know, well, what are we going to do next year? Where are we going to hunt? I said, you know, we had a lot of bulls bugling in Idaho and had a lot of close. Let's go back there. So we went back for 2 weeks, and that year we learned that there's trails that go through all this brush, and we learned a lot more area that year. And you know, we hunted that from 89 through 2003, mm-hmm. and just had a ball over there. We got to know the area well, and we had multiple bulls in all the time and got a lot of bulls taken home with us. And mm-hmm. it was fun. It was just a blast. And during some of those days, I'm sure that I'm on this hillside and you're on that hillside and I'm beagling to you and you're beagling to me. And we're going, oh, there's hunters there. What the heck are they doing in
there's
here?
Some guy over there.
And Dirk's over there going, what the heck's that guy over there for?
Yeah, yeah. I think we probably crossed paths in the mountains, but not close enough to know to meet each other.
Right, and we'd go by where you were camped, and we'd go, oh, we'd wave at the camp on the way by.
Yep, yep.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, things were different back then, definitely.
They were.
A lot more elk. Ron did a thing that's really cool. It's not unique. I mean, there's other people that do it. And I know as far as regrets in my hunting life, I wish I would have done this because I love interesting data and facts. But Ron has kept a journal log of encounters and call-ins and how many elk they heard, seen, moon phases from 1989 till last year.
I just don't have the last, I don't have the last 5 years on my data sheet.
You haven't updated your data sheet.
Right. The yearly or the total data sheet.
Your printed up one.
Yeah.
But yeah. So what kind of a trend have you seen from 1989 to modern times?
So from 1989 through 1994, we were seeing on the average of 20 bulls a year and had 25 close encounters a year. And to me, a close encounter is when the bull is within 60 yards, I can see him, mm-hmm. and there's a good shot possibility. Mm-hmm. So for those however many years, we had that kind of stats. And then 95, it went down, and 96, we had the hard winters there in 95, 96. So
yeah.
In 96 and 97, it dropped down to 8 per year on Bull's Scene and 12 per year on Close Encounters. And then it started trending back up through about 2003, went back up to 14 bulls a year and 6 encounters or 15 encounters a year. And then the wolves showed up. And they were starting to get there in 2003 even.
Yeah.
And you know, like one night we're in bed sleeping, you hear them coming down the road howling. Mm-hmm. And you know, get up the next day and there's all these huge wolf tracks out in the road.
It's yeah.
Like, oh my gosh. Well, after that happened for the next, what do I have? 2003 was the last year we hunted that particular area. We saw 6 bulls and had 6 close encounters. Said, okay, that's it. We're moving somewhere else in the unit.
Yeah, you've went from 20 to 25 a year down to 6.
6, yeah.
Yeah, that's
it's discouraging.
It's a stark difference.
Yeah. And the vegetation hadn't changed that much. The feed, you know, the habitat hadn't changed. I mean, it changed a little bit, but not enough to do that to the numbers. And
yeah,
the only common denominator was wolves.
Yeah.
You know, and so we moved over east further in the unit. We were seeing 14 bulls a year and 15 close encounters for the next 4 years. And then it went down to 6 bulls and 6 close encounters again. We said, mm-hmm. And there were wolf tracks all over the roads and they're howling at night again.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, let's get out of here. So we went to another area. And we were seeing up there, you know, it was our first few years up there. We were seeing 9 bulls a year, 9 close encounters. And so we said, okay, forget that one. Let's go somewhere else. And we got another one that we were seeing 10 and 8 a year, mm-hmm. close encounters, mm-hmm. which the difference there is it was thicker. It was actually thicker than where we had been hunting.
Yeah.
And to see a bull and get a close encounter was a lot harder. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of bugles going up there. We got a number of bugles going up there.
Yeah, you heard a lot of different bulls, but then the close encounters and then visual eyes on bulls went right way down because it's just such thick country.
It's only 20 yard. You know, we were shooting 20 yards up there is all maximum.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it definitely changed.
But, yeah.
And we kind of migrated down to this other area, and I ran into somebody down there named Dirk.
Yeah, and yeah, it's funny because I think the year that I seen you up there in the woods, finally, we crossed paths. And we'd been hunting some of the same areas for the last 30 years and yeah. never run across each other in the woods that we knew of. We might even passed each other by
and waved. Probably passed and waved,
never yeah. talked, you know. But at the Sportsman Show in Portland in, what was it, 2018 maybe?
Probably something like that.
Then yeah. you introduced yourself, and what I kind of talked about, we sat there and talked like schoolgirls and stuff, and we knew the places we used to hunt, but now we didn't really talk a lot about where we hunt currently. Like,
yeah.
We kind of left little tidbits, like, I kind of hang around where you hunt, but we didn't really say names yeah. or anything.
You don't ever say names to somebody else.
No, you don't. That's, yeah, we would laugh about it. Hey, you guys see anything hunting?
No.
No, I haven't seen a thing. Elk is, man, I haven't heard an elk. Of course, you know, it's elk hunters, you know, talking to each, you know, one camp to another. You know, you never share or divulge your information because, you know, you don't want the other guys sneaking in there on your spot. If they see your pickup, then they're going to be looking for that bull you've been bugling. So yeah. Anyhow, fast forward. So that was 2018, the winter of 2018 we talked.
Yeah.
And met finally face to face. And then that fall during Mouth Tab Madness if you guys haven't watched my YouTube channel, it's called The Bugler. And I do a series of videos called Mouth Tab Madness. I'd injured my shoulder that fall elk hunting, and I had to relearn how to shoot a bow with using a mouth tab. Had to bite on the tab attached to the string with my teeth and then push the bow forward with my left arm, line up my eyeball to my peep sight, and then shoot. And that's how I went hunting that fall. The rest of that fall was with this mouth tab bow. Anyway, we're up there. Me and cameraman Dusty had just hiked up, had a wet day of and bugle fest. We'd been chasing these bugles around, and we got back to the pickup, and I heard a vehicle coming. I'm like, quick, Dusty, hide, because I don't like to talk to people in the woods, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but I don't want them asking me questions.
You don't want to have to lie.
I don't want to have to lie to them. They're like, oh, I haven't heard a thing. You know, I just rather not talk to them. I don't want to pump people for information, and I don't want them to pump me for information. So I'm like, come here, Dusty, let's hide behind the pickup. So we kind of hid behind the pickup, and this guy pulls up, and he just stops. I'm like, oh, dang it. And then I can hear his window go. Bzzz. He's like, come on out, guys. I see you hiding back there. I hear this voice. I'm like, oh, dang it. We're had. And I walk around, and into my dismay, it's Ron. And I can see the same surprise in his eyes. He's like, oh, Dirk, this is where you hunt. I'm like, dang it. So we had a good visit there. We probably talked way too long in the middle of the road there instead of going hunting, but it was good to reconnect. And you told us where you were camped, and we ended up coming out to your camp later on. But anyhow, that's when we finally ran into each other.
Yeah, in the woods.
In the woods. And I have some.
Well, we'd actually seen each other just a little bit before that, because we were road beagling one night, and we're standing beside the road beagling down this draw, and Ron had nature called, so he's standing there, and here comes a rig around the corner a little. And they're coming by, and they're just laughing, and I'm laughing because I know what I'm doing. They're laughing because they know what I'm doing. Well, we talked to Dirk later, and he said, yeah, I was laughing because we were beagling at each other. I go, I was laughing for a different reason, Dirk.
Got caught with your pants down.
Yeah, and then when we ran into them after they were done hunting, we'd heard the bulls beagling up there that morning, but we had in mind we wanted to go somewhere else and hunt, so we did, and to our dismay, there was nothing there. So we said, let's go back and go to that area where the bulls were this morning. So we went to the back side of it, and there's a rig park there. It's like, oh my gosh, let's go to the other side and climb the steep face. And that's when we found Dirk over there. He'd been up there chasing my bulls that morning.
Man, that's awesome. And it's funny, like my experience is like, I wish I'd have wrote them all down. That way I'd have that hard data. I just have to go on memory. Right. But I remember, you know, the same kind of trends, you know, you would hear lots of bugles, lots of every year, different bulls, and you'd have, you know, you would get eyes on bulls and then close encounters. And a lot of people will throw around, oh yeah, I called in 47 bulls last year. But did you really call in 47 bulls? In my mind, calling in a bull is having a bull either come in to within archery range or very close to it. So he's traveled a long ways from where he was at originally, and he came to your calls, and you almost get him. Or let's say a bull comes from half a mile away and stands on a hillside 100 or 200 yards away and looks back and paces back and forth and bugles at you, but then he don't come any further because he's like, he wants to see elk or he wants you to make a move, but then he kind of goes back. That's a call in too.
Yeah.
But I know people that will hunt some of the same areas I hunt, and they'll be like, oh yeah, we called in 49 bulls last year. I'm like, but did you? I mean, I don't think you're counting. I don't think you're counting call-ins like me. I think maybe the amount of bugles you heard.
I'd say maybe they got 49 answers.
Yeah. But you know what? Gee whiz. I guess if that's what makes you float your boat and keeps you going every day, I mean,
it doesn't matter.
You know, bless your heart. I mean, I guess you can count them however you want, right?
Yeah.
Nope. Same as turkeys, right? Oh, he called in these turkeys.
Called in 100 turkeys today.
Except when they got off the roost, they went the other way.
And half of them were hens.
And half were hens. But that, you know, that where we met you, we ran into you. If the first year I hunted that spot there was in 2007, and that year, my buddy Brent and I, we'd heard 35 different bulls bugle in a week. And I was like, wow, this is great, because my old spot I used to go had been really good and then gone way downhill, just like what you said, you know. Yeah. You know, I think the last year I hunted there, I think I had two close encounters, and I heard like three bulls the whole time.
Yeah.
And just heard them. And I got on almost all of them. I got on all of them, but you know, I guess out of the three bulls, I got on two of them and had a close encounter. But anyhow, fast forward, you know, to 2007, you know, 35 bulls we heard in a week, and had lots of close encounters. I didn't really count those up, but I'd have to kind of go back to the old memory banks and write them down and kind of figure it out. But lots of close encounters, very, you know, tension on the string, drawn back a few times and almost got them to when we met you in 2019, we had, I don't know, we probably heard like maybe 10 bugles that year and had three or four close encounters.
In 2019?
Yeah. And he's gonna look at his Bible here, his elk hunting Bible.
2019, we heard a total of 33 bulls and saw 5 bulls.
Wow.
And had 4 close encounters.
Man, you sandbagger. you when I talked to you in the woods, you said, "Oh yeah, we've heard a couple bulls here and there," but well, you weren't being truthful.
Well, you probably weren't either.
I wasn't at all. Yeah, you guys said, "Oh, did you get into them up there?" I'm like, "Oh, we heard a couple bugles up there."
I know better.
The brush, and well, we weren't real truthful either.
Yeah, little did you know, I sit down there and listen to them all morning before we left.
Yeah, yeah, but
yeah, it was a good year.
but just the stark contrast, you know, and then fast forward to like 2022. That was the last time I hunted up in that country, and that was the Ghost Bull video you guys watched. If you haven't watched it, it's on YouTube. The Ghost Bull.
Yeah.
That
was a good one.
Ghost Bulls of the North or something. I can't
remember. Yeah, Ghost Bulls of the North.
That was the video on YouTube on the Phelps Game Calls YouTube channel. And I think I heard 5 bulls that year and had 3 close encounters. As in, I was... You know, I was within shooting range of bulls. So it had even gone downhill from 2019 to 2022 in my mind. A lot less sign and, you know, a lot of hunter activity. But, you know, I'm kind of going to some places you don't see a lot of people. But still, it's just the elk numbers are not there.
Right. There used to be a lot more in there.
Yeah. And in my mind, just from – I feel like I'm about as educated as any biologist, probably more so than any biologists that are out there now. Most biologists, they read things, they look at spreadsheets, they look at that kind of data. Ron and I are out there surveying the landscape, the countryside, firsthand experience.
Yeah.
We're covering the country. We're digging in. I would dare say way more than anybody that's like doing any kind of biology assessment of an area. You know, we're boots on the ground. We're walking in places people don't normally walk unless you have like an elk calling to you. Like, you're not going to walk down in these crap holes if there's not a bull bugling. Like, you're not going to walk down there to write something on a sheet of paper.
To see what's down there.
Just to see what's down there. You're just not going to do it. So anyway, I feel like we have a pretty good gauge on what has happened to Idaho's elk, North Idaho's elk. Certain parts of Idaho, elk are flourishing.
Yeah.
Other parts of Idaho, they're diminishing.
But where they're flourishing, do they have many wolves?
Not as many.
Yeah.
No, or any. You know, not as many or any. But wolves are starting to find some of those places now. I have friends and, you know, in the southern part of the state, you know, if you cut the skinny part of Idaho off and make a box out of the southern part of the state, you know, make a rectangular box.
Yeah.
The areas in those places, you know, I feel like they have better elk herds. I probably shouldn't say that, but I know on the fringes of the northern part of the box, I know people are starting to say, you know, man, we're starting to see more wolves and starting to see more wolves. And they'd seen wolves before and they kind of came and went, but now they're back and they're finding deadheads, lots of deadhead elk. They're starting to make an impact in a lot of areas, especially with the kind of winters we've been having last year. This winter wasn't too bad, but the winter of 2022-2023 was devastating to South Idaho.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's, you know, what got those wolves, you know, they just followed the herds through down into the lower country as the time went by. But anyhow, some might say, like if we go back to Northern Idaho, some will say, you know, it's all about habitat, you know, the habitat loss. Because in 1910, there was a giant wildfire that went from north central Idaho clear way up into the Panhandle and burned millions of acres of the national forest, which after 40 years, when it grew back, it was amazing elk habitat. You know, the burnt had opened up the canopy, you know, grasses and small shrubs growing everywhere. And it was a perfect storm because, you know, back in them days, not a lot of people in Idaho. And then around World War II, pre-World War II, they'd even shut down hunting seasons in a lot of those units because they'd had some bad winters and they wanted the elk to come back and flourish. And they did. And they opened up seasons again. Anyhow, the elk hunting was fantastic. And George Bedis got to hunt onto the tail end of some of that there in the 70s and early 80s of that fantastic elk hunting. And if you listen to that podcast, his stories were incredible.
Oh, yeah.
But to understand in the 40s and 50s, it was twice as good. It was, if you can even wrap your head around how good that was, it was twice as good. It had the nation's best elk herd in a relatively small area compared to like the whole state of Colorado now that has the largest elk herd in America.
Right.
So, but anyway, now we're in 2024, those forests have grown up. They've aged. They've matured. They've choked out, you know, grasses. They've choked out, you know, the underbrush has matured and gotten really tall. So you don't have all the tender things to eat at more just little above ground level. So the feed has changed. So people will say, the experts will say, well, it's more of a habitat issue than a wolf issue. And I think both sides are right to a certain degree. So if you have elk that should have really great feed, if they have really great feed everywhere and they're pressured by wolves, they just keep moving until, you know, okay, it's okay. We'll just go live over here. There's good food here. And they just keep following the food and the wolves follow them. They're probably going to stay more nourished and probably have less mortality. But as it is now, you know, we have a lot of mature forests and stuff. There's less quality habitat. The wolves pursue, they distress the elk. They're not as in good a shape because they don't have as good as feed. And then they're easier prey because they maybe find some good food, a good food source, and don't want to leave it. And then the wolves go in and wipe them out. And this is all just my theory. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with some of it that has grown up into old forest, old growth. But then you start out where you go back to where you and I first hunted over there.
Yeah.
And that is all burnt. That's all. There's been fires go through all that country. And so it's reforesting, and it's got the open grasses. It's mm-hmm. got the habitat for them. Mm-hmm. And you were back there last year rifle hunting, and you found zero in there.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, there used to be tons of elk in there, and now there is good food. If it was the habitat, there's great food for them in there, mm-hmm. but there's still no elk.
Right. Yeah, for about a decade ago, that country started burning again. Between burning, and then there's a lot of beetle kill timber that's yep. falling, you know, and opening up the canopy as well. But you're still not seeing elk. And then, you know, what George talked about, you know, a good friend of his who is a biologist for the Forest Service in that area, a forestry guy, he said, you know, they need to prescribe burns in the winter habitat, you know, to get those, you know, those burns we're talking about, a lot of them are up on top.
On top, yeah.
You know, they're not in the winter range, but conversely, you know, at the time, I wanted to hear George's opinion, and I didn't want to, you know, take counterpoint on it. But I got to thinking about, like, well, okay, that does make sense. That's a fair assumption. But then I look at the Frank Church Wilderness. All you got to do is go to Google Earth and look at the Frank Church Wilderness. It's all burnt from the river to the highest peaks. Yeah. Most of it. It's a huge, vast wasteland of burn, wasteland as far as like timber, but now there's grasses, small trees, you know, like jack firs and brush, lush brush growing. Where are the elk? They haven't made a return there. There's nobody's saying, good Lord, you know, the outfitters aren't getting rich in the Frank Church Wilderness because there's so many elk and they have so many clients coming in. There's a lot of outfitters that have gone out of business.
Yeah.
And I haven't talked to too many people lately that said, oh, the Frank Church is on fire with elk right now. You actually ask people, and they're like, yeah, there's elk, but
far and few between.
They kind of tell the same kind of stories we tell about the places we've been hunting. You know, if you know the pockets where they live, you'll get into them. But if you don't, you could spend a whole week there or a 10-day hunt and not see a dang elk or hear an elk.
Yeah, you could walk forever through the brush piles and just beat yourself to death.
But anyway, yeah, I don't know what the easy answer is, because they have, you know, with trapping and stuff. And then I know the Idaho Fish and Game have flown missions with their helicopters and, you know, to reduce numbers of wolves. You know, they shoot a bunch and they help certain areas where the elk are suffering, or maybe cattle. And then the trappers are getting a fair share of them. And I think, I think they're just kind of keeping them at bay. They've reduced some of the numbers, but they've kind of keep them at bay. And I don't know. Something has to happen drastically to get those elk to come back in those places.
So that takes you to the next thing, is where the elk drop their calves.
Yes.
Guess what's down there?
Bears.
The bears.
Yep.
So has the bear population increased enough to where they're hurting the herds by killing enough calves? I don't know.
I think they put a dent in them, definitely. Yeah. I think there's a lot of bears. I don't think it's like the bears we had in the 80s, but right. We don't have the amount of elk as we had in the 80s.
Right.
But
and there's more cougars now, too, than there were.
Yep.
So, you know, everything's trying to, like a turkey we were talking.
Yeah.
A turkey doesn't have a friend one in the woods except for a deer. Yeah. Everything else wants to eat them.
It's on everyone's menu.
Yeah. I mean, coyote says, oh, yum. Bobcat, oh, yeah. Cougar, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But an elk is, you know, there's a lot of things trying to eat the elk, too. Between the bear, the cougar, and the wolves.
Yeah.
You know, they're, yeah.
They're now,
prime fare.
Now, am I calling for the eradication of wolves?
Nope.
Or bears or
nope.
Cougars.
Nope.
No, but it has to be a good balance, right?
Yes, you have to balance it out.
It's got
to
be a balance. And being I'm an animal lover. I love all animals.
Yes.
And I want to see them all do well, but not at the expense of the other one. You know, I don't right. want all the elk to be gone, and I don't want all the wolves to be gone, and all the cougars and the mountain lions or the bears. And I don't want to see something disappear completely off the
no,
landscape.
Not at all.
But we have to manage them.
It is smarter. Cool to hear a wolf howl.
It is
just a neat, I mean, it's an airy sound, but it's cool to hear.
Yeah. Them. And I love dogs. People may not know this about me, but I love dogs. I have a black lab. I've had black labs. I've had dogs my whole entire adult life. And I love dogs. And I feel like wolves are interesting. Dogs are intelligent. Dogs are way smarter than people usually give them credit for. And especially they're very in touch with their emotions. I think dogs are more self-aware than a lot of people will acknowledge or understand. So you think wolves are very self-aware. They're very intelligent. They learn very quickly about danger, about food. They learn very quickly about everything. And so I can appreciate that. They're an interesting animal. They have an interesting family dynamic. They have a different kind of way of life, you know, which is interesting, which should be appreciated.
Yep.
But also, I can appreciate when they're overpopulated, then other animal species suffer. And I don't appreciate that.
Right.
I don't want that to happen. I want there to be a balance.
To go from 15,000 elk herd down to 1,500 elk herd, something's wrong.
Something's wrong. And it happened within a 2-3 year period.
Yeah. It just went boom.
Is what happened. And the habitat didn't just fail.
You know,
as there's less elk on the landscape, think of this, you know, you say habitat, as there's less elk on the landscape, there's more food on the landscape.
Yeah.
Because it's not like all the grass and brush died in North Idaho.
No.
If anything, it's brushier than it's ever been. Everywhere you look's food.
Yeah, it is. It's a jungle. That's the best way to describe it.
Like an elk doesn't have to walk far for food. Like they can like walk 3 feet. Oh, there's something else to eat.
Yeah, they love the huckleberry brush.
They walk 50 yards. Oh, there's water. they have everything they need, except I think the wolves have done quite a number on them, and I think they do definitely need to restore a lot of the winter habitat by doing prescribed burns. But as my friend George said, you know, that's a politically charged thing. You know, we start burning, you know, there's a lot of folks who suffer from asthma and stuff, and it makes it hard for them to breathe. Well, they get pushback. The Forest Service gets pushback on air quality.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to make everyone happy, you know, unfortunately.
Yeah. But you have to look at the money that hunters put into the economy.
Yep.
And I think as hunters, you know, buying license and tags and all this stuff, you've promoted the game and built up the herds to where they were, mm-hmm. you know, so that was, and then to be managed responsibly at that level, you know, to keep the herds up, and then something else comes into the equation that wasn't there before and changes everything. So you have to stop and reexamine how you're doing things.
Yep.
And I don't know. I don't have the answers. I wish I did.
Well, here's a topic we could spin off of this and go down another rabbit hole. Logging. You know, they've ceased logging for the most part on, by and large, on national forest.
Yes.
Okay, we can't burn that. We can't burn these winter grounds. Can we log them? No. And I'm not saying put in new roads into these places, but people can helicopter log, right? That's that's a very effective tool. You're not scarring the landscape with roads. You make the roads that are existing roads better. Cut the timber, fly it to the nearest road landing and truck it out. You know, that now again, we're stimulating the economy. We're creating dollars. We're getting people putting back to where we're getting tax money that will help maintain the forest.
Right.
Yet the same people who don't want you to log, they don't want you to burn. Well, some of them, but it seems like, you know, we don't want you to log the forest, but what happens in the end is, well, wildfire, and it ends up burning anyway.
Yeah, and it's worse because nothing's restored yet.
Yeah, and it's the middle of summer. It's July and August, and now air quality all over the northwestern part of the United States, the skies are brown for the whole month of August.
You're spending money to fight the fires instead of making money by logging it.
Yes,
just doesn't compute for me.
Yeah, in areas where there's a lot of different ownerships of land. You know, you have state, you have private timber companies, you have national forest. In those areas, you definitely see a difference in elk numbers because they've opened up the forest in those places. So I do believe habitat does have something to do with it.
Yes.
Because even with the presence of predators, the elk do better.
And the fires don't do as well because they hit these blocks that have been logged and they can extinguish them, you know, knock them down.
So. Yeah, we don't have those multi-million acre burns like we had in 1910.
Yeah.
So anyway, man, I wish we could just, you know, I think we've just solved the world's problems here, Ron.
Oh, I'm too old for that.
Man, it's been really fun. As always, I appreciate you hosting me and bringing me over here. I cherish the time we get to spend together. And
I enjoy it a lot. It's fun.
We talk about life and
laugh.
giggle and laugh. And you cook good food for me. You love to cook and I love to eat. I mean, anybody that's seen me knows I love
combination.
To eat. That's a great duo.
We gave Dirk his first razor clams the other night for dinner.
First razor clams. I've never had those before. Jason Phelps, thanks a lot for invite. He lives very close to the coast.
And I dig where he goes probably. So.
Yeah. I had to come to my good friend Ron's house to get razor clams. I hope you're listening, Jason. You know, if you guys have questions or comments, you can always email them in to ctd@phelpsgamecalls.com.
Yeah. Cutting the distance.
Yeah. ctd@phelpsgamecalls.com. And send an email to Jason Phelps and say, hey, why didn't you have Dirk over for razor clams? I thought you guys were friends. I'm starting to question our friendship.
Make sure he gives you razor clams and not mud clams.
Yeah. Well, he'll probably eat the razor clams when I'm not there. He's like, oh, we got some of these other, we call them M clams, short for mud. But anyway, anything to wrap this up? Any last thoughts? Do you have any regrets or looking back at your long hunting life, like, man, I wish I'd have done something that you just didn't do. And looking back, you wish you could have done something different.
So when I was learning the hunting, starting out in Oregon, and I don't even know where I heard about bugling. I was excited. I thought, I want to call elk. I want to hear a bugle. So I don't know if it was herders or what. Back in the day, I ordered some turkey diaphragm calls you can make yourself. And I made my own diaphragms and I used them for bugling.
Oh, yeah.
Or I was younger and my voice worked better and I could do a throat bugle with my own voice.
Did you suck in or did you scream?
Soaking in.
I try to do that. I sound like a stuck pig or something. It sounds terrible.
Yeah. Well, I called a nice 5-point in one day and here came a hunter down upwind from him and gone.
Got them both. Yeah. You fooled them both.
Oh yeah. It was like, oh my gosh.
You must have been pretty good.
But I made my own diaphragms and tried those. And then they had, you know, I don't remember what calls. Larry Jones came out with them. Yeah. I got the squealer thing and got my first bull to really answer and come in later on. And he was ripping up a tree. And I thought, I'm sitting here waiting for him to come walking out in front of me. And he left.
Oh,
you know,
man.
So it's like, oh, well, that's not how it goes. And then I taught myself. I learned it myself just by doing it. And like we were talking back in the day, there were enough elk in Idaho. If we blew this one, let's go to the next one a mile away.
Yeah.
You know, and do it again. And That was how we learned. It was just trial and error.
Yeah.
And it ends up that you and I bugle a lot alike now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like we're sitting here talking. It's like, yeah. Aggressive, aggressive. Aggressive means this, not this. Mm-hmm. And if the bull gets aggressive sounding, we get aggressive sounding. Mm-hmm. But if he's not, we're aggressive pushing him, getting closer and making him mad. So
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the only regrets I have, not a whole lot, just a few.
Yeah.
You know, I wish I had more patience at times.
Yeah.
That is one of the key things for somebody learning, patience. Just because he hasn't showed up within 2 minutes doesn't mean he's not going to be within 10 minutes. It's just like turkey hunting.
Yep.
If a turkey doesn't show up and he's quiet, he might be coming in quiet.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with an elk.
Yep.
So I've learned a lot of patience, especially now that I'm older. I don't like to move as much, and it hurts to go, and so I learned to stop a lot. So.
Yeah. Well, I think Kenny Rogers said it best. You got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. No, that's about it. I have just thoroughly enjoyed my time in the woods and learning about elk. Like, you know, I was telling you stories the other day, what I've seen with elk, how the cow falling in a bog head over heels.
Yeah.
Calf getting beat on by a cow, and you know, it's just there's so many things you see. Watched an elk get spooked, you know, spike a grouse flew up at its feet, and the spike just did somersaults trying to get out of there. So you see so many cool things when you are out in the woods getting to watch that stuff, and that's what I enjoy.
Yeah, it's so all the times I've been by myself hunting and I didn't have anybody with me, and I've seen some amazing things. Like, nobody's gonna ever believe this story. And it was long before you videotaped anything, and I was by myself, and it's like, man, that was so cool. And it's one regret. I've hunted it by myself a lot in my life, and I enjoy it. I love it. I prefer it. But when something remarkable happens, I regret that I didn't have someone there with me to share that moment with. Like, can you believe that just happened?
Yeah.
That's the coolest thing I've ever seen.
No.
So.
Another regret is that we didn't run into each other back in the 1990s. And then start hunting together and with our group, you know, it would have been,
I would have seen your license plate though. I'd have been like, them damn Oregonian hunters with out of standards, get out of Idaho. No, I'm just kidding. But I wish we'd have like found each other back then and could have chased those same mountains that we love so much together. That would have been so much fun.
It would have been. And now you're not hunting where I'm hunting anymore.
Yep.
So I'll have to give you a report card this year after it's over.
Yeah. And we'll just have to, you know, we have turkey hunting, Ron.
That's right.
We'll always have turkey hunting.
Yep. That's for darn sure.
Well, thanks again. How can people find you? Do you want to let people know where they can find you on social if they want to follow you?
I don't have any idea.
Okay.
I don't. I don't know if it's just Ron Hewitt on Facebook and something Ron Hewitt on Instagram. Yep. I don't know. I don't post much on there normally.
Just family stuff.
And I probably posted a picture of you the other day because I had 11-year memory or something on April 15th with me with a bird, and it said add. So I put your picture on there. It shows up, I don't even know how to find that. So
right on. Well, again, I thank you for having me over, and thanks for getting on the podcast. You know, I know
that was the first. I said I was never going to do this, Dirk.
I know. You told me I'm never getting on a podcast, and I'm like, Ron, you got to do it. Like
I'm sweating and trembling and shaking.
Yeah.
And
that's, you know, one of my life's regrets is not knowing when my dad passed away, before he passed in 2009. And back then I hadn't even heard of a podcast. I didn't even know what a podcast was. And it wasn't mainstream media by no means. And I regret that I hadn't recorded. My mom always wanted my dad, because my dad, he's a very colorful person, crazy stories. Like, he lived a hell of a life, from, you know, storming the beaches of Iwo Jima to living and working in Liberia, Africa back in the 60s. And, you know, hunted the Idaho's backcountry when it was the very best, right out of World War II in the 40s and 50s. And just, he experienced such a wide range of experiences in life.
Yeah.
My mom always tried to get him to like record something, like a little tape recorder. And I think he kind of felt weird about it. He's like, psh, I'm not doing that, you know. But if we had been able to sneak or something, or sit down and I wish I could have had an opportunity to podcast and record all these wild stories he had and life experiences. I do regret that.
Yeah.
It was awesome. And that's why I really wanted you to get on here, because I want to pick your brain and record you and hear your spin on life and elk hunting. So I appreciate that.
Spin on life is enjoy it while it's here. We never know about tomorrow. It's all in God's hands. So.
Yep. Absolutely.
Just enjoy every day. Make the most of it.
Yep.
Make the friends and enjoy your friendships.
Yep.
So
I love that.
Yeah.
All right.
And family too.
And family. Yep. Absolutely. Oh,
definitely family.
Family first. Yep. Well, thanks, Ron, and we'll catch everybody on the next one.
Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate Batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate Batteries. I use Interstate Batteries in my boats. I use Interstate Batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. Hey, everybody, listen up. I got mega huge news. Meat Eater Live is heading back out on the road. That's right. Join me and the crew. Clay Newcomb, Cal, Yanni, Spencer's going to be there. Phil the Engineer is going to be there. Meat Eater Live, headed back out. Now, when you get every ticket, okay, every ticket you buy, you get a signed copy of our new Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook. This tour is celebrating the release of the book. Buy a ticket, get a signed copy, Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, camp stove, and campfire, which I'll point out is a $38 value. Here's where we're going to go. April 23rd, the Mesa Arts Center in Mesa, Arizona. April 24th, the Balboa Theater in San Diego. April 25th, the Grove in Anaheim, California. April 27th, the Crest Theater in Sacramento. April 29, the Union in Salt Lake City. April 30, the Egyptian in Boise. May 1, the Wilma Theater in Missoula. May 2, the Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, Washington. May 4, Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. And May 5, the last day of the tour, Pantages Theater in Tacoma, Washington. For tickets and more information, visit the events page at the Meat Eater.com. Hope to see you at the show.